Lots of hard stuff happening in the world today, and we're going to end with one that's coming home, and it begins with a warning.
Current and future emissions matter, but this will happen no matter what we do about emissions. This report is a wake-up call for the United States, but it's a wake-up call that comes with a silver lining.
I will take a silver lining on a wake-up call. That is Rick Spinrad, Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, talking last week about a new report on the state of sea level rise. The report presents five predictions for the level of sea level rise that will happen between now and 2100. At the low end of the scale, so low-end scenario, we could see as little as 2 feet. On the high end, 7. So imagine, you know, more than your couch underwater right now. The report says that our actions today will determine how much it rises, but they won't stop it. Sea level rise is coming. We are now in an age, it argues, that it is, well, inevitable. So here to talk more about what this rise in sea level means for our coastal and inland residents here in Massachusetts and ways that we can lessen the inevitable's impacts. We have Rebecca Hurst. She is the director of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at UMass Boston, and Andrew Gottlieb. He is the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Rebecca, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Andrew, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here with you.
All right. So, Rebecca, 2 feet of water. Help us get our heads around how much that is. What does that look like?
So if we have, you know, when we think about the flooding that we had in 2018, when we had 2 1% chance floods in just 2 months, that amount of flooding we could see at mid-century with 1 foot of sea level rise happening much, much more frequently. So when we see 2 feet of sea level rise, you know, it's even more than that. And when we get to 5 or 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, we could see that amount of flooding twice daily at high tide.
No, that's okay. Yeah, go ahead. No. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, just if we don't do anything, much of the coast would no longer be livable.
Okay, so that's so interesting, Rebecca, because what you're saying is, okay, as a layperson on this subject, when you tell me a lot of water, right, the water's coming up, what I think about is how deep it gets. But what you're saying is this is also frequency of when it's going to hit us, and that both are associated with this sea level rise, right?
Exactly. And what I was just talking about was like sunny day flooding, not thinking about adding in a storm on top of that.
So, Andrew, I'm going to be deliberately obtuse here for just a second. Sunny day flooding is a thing?
Sunny day flooding is currently a thing. We have already seen increases in tide levels as a result of warming that has occurred over the last couple of centuries and is accelerating. So we're already seeing in places like Shore Road and Falmouth, sort of an iconic coastal road, probably 10 or 12 times a year on high tides, on bright sunny days or moonlit nights, when that roadway becomes flooded. That is going to occur more and more. And in fact, the long-term 30-year plan for the town of Falmouth is to abandon that road because it will be underwater so frequently.
So, Rachel, I'm going to play a little sound on this subject. We spoke with your colleague, Ellen Douglas, who's professor of hydrology in the School for the Environment at UMass Boston. Here she is.
Even if we didn't have a change in storms, with increased sea level rise, these storm surges, which are basically a big pile of water that the winds push ahead of a storm, they'll just reach farther inland. So we would have increased flooding.
So basically, I mean, again, I think the layperson tends to think you have a flood when it rains a lot and then the water comes up. But this is, hey, on a bad day, a windy day with the sun out, boom, here it comes just because of general sea level rise. Is that right?
Yes. And when there is a storm, you know, it goes in even further, right? So, and I think as you're saying, you know, often when we're thinking about sea level rise, we really think of just water on top of the land and where we are. But this also impacts our, you know, saltwater intrusion, like it impacts the water table. So there would be more flooding of basements, harder to drain after a storm, wastewater issues. So there's lots of different implications to having additional sea level rise much higher.
So, Andrew, I want to get my mind around what this means for coastal communities on the Cape, which are treasures for all of us. And, of course, we imagine them being particularly vulnerable. Is it just houses and basements? What else do we see as long-term damage or impact here?
No, in many respects, it's everything. So it's beaches. A lot of our beaches, obviously, are low-lying and close to sea level. And there'll be loss of those beach areas, further dune erosion, a lot of the municipal parking lots that provide easy access to vacationing and year-round population to the beach. Those will be either gone or underwater with great frequency. There'll be an effort among many property owners to armor the shoreline under their homes at the bottom of the bank. And what we found, given armoring in the past, where people put hard structures up to protect their land from erosion, is that the beach underneath it disappears. Mm. So what we could be looking at is a Cape without beaches or without ready access to beaches. In addition, a lot of our low-lying areas, the coastal marshes, provide a multitude of environmental services, from flood protection to flood storage, habitat for fin fisheries and birds and migrating fowl. And those resources, those marshes are not going to be able to migrate inland with the speed at which we're expecting sea level to rise. So we're going to lose a lot of marsh habitat. That means that floodwaters that we're going to be stored in those marshes under typical and normal circumstances has to go somewhere. And that somewhere is onto roads, public infrastructure, and people's property. So, you know, not only do we lose the flood storage capability, we're also going to lose a lot of environmental habitat, breeding grounds, and become a much less robust environment as a result.
Okay, so Andrew, at the beginning, I talked about those five levels of scenarios, right? With a low scenario to a high potential scenario, the low at least is coming. So the habitat stuff you just talked about, I think I hear you saying that's just coming no matter what. Is that right?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of warming and melting and sea level rise that are cooked into the atmosphere and cooked into the equation now.
And the no beaches on the Cape thing?
Well,
I'm assuming that's more on the high end of this potential
that
spectrum.
That tends to come on the high end, but it also comes from decisions that we're going to make about how we're managing the uplands above these coastal marsh area and coastal dune areas. You know, and embedded in that is a discussion and that we haven't really had very well yet about what our response is going to be in terms of relocating facilities, relocating homes. To what extent are we going to invest anything and everything to protect a home for a short period of time and lose the beach underneath it? So the Cape really, along with the rest of the coastal regions, has to come to grips with that reality and make some decisions and decide what we want to look like in the future.
Do you have time to have that discussion and make those decisions?
Certainly there is time remaining. I think that we are late to the conversation. I think most towns have only now begun to grapple with what's likely to come. There are some great tools that have been done. This NOAA report provides some ability to look forward. Cape Cod Commission has an interesting tool, a coastal planner tool on their website that lets you look at segments and begin to play with different levels of sea level rise, where the flooding is going to be, where the slosh zones are going to be, and what our options are. And you already see towns, Sandwich, they're relocating their police and fire station from the coastal area of Route 6A inland because of increased flooding and frequency of flooding that we're already experiencing. Towns, Brewster and Orleans, have looked at moving back parking lots. So it's already happening. It's happening in a disjointed way. I think this study helps crystallize that we're either going to adapt or we're going to lose facilities and we're going to have an uncontrolled change to our landscape.
Okay, turning back to you now, Rebecca Hurst of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at UMass Boston. We spoke with Paul Kirshen, who is the director of the Stone Living Lab at UMass Boston, about this idea that this is going to affect a lot of people on the coast, but what about people much deeper inland? And he made the case for why this matters basically to everyone. Here he is.
Boston Harbor no longer existed. Everything that comes into Boston Harbor wouldn't get into the inland communities. Also, the coast, particularly in Massachusetts, is really important for our tourism and recreation. And many of the people in the inland communities commute into Boston. So what happens in Boston really impacts really all of New England.
So, Rebecca, when I hear it's going to hit everybody, then I hear what I've learned about environmental justice, which is when an environmental impact hits everybody, it hits the people who are most vulnerable and most marginalized first and harder. Is that the case
here?
Yes,
exactly.
So talk about that.
Definitely. So I think it's helpful to think about both chronic stressors and more disruptive shocks when we're thinking about the way that climate change is playing a role in our lives. So chronic stressors with sea level rise are things like flood insurance going up and then being that cost being passed on to renters, or basements flooding more often and people not being able to waterproof them and having molds in apartments and causing more asthma. In Miami, we're seeing that areas that were traditionally less desirable because they were on higher ground and farther from the water are now having property prices skyrocket as people realize that they need to move away from the coast. So there are lots of different chronic stressors that really can play a role in people's lives and the ways that sea level rise will impact the city as a whole. And that's not even thinking about, you know, a big disaster, a big storm with catastrophic impacts. So when we think about a catastrophic storm, if we're thinking about both before the storm, during the storm, and after the storm, there are all sorts of ways that historically marginalized communities get the short end of the stick. We have a faculty member, Rosalyn Negron, who's doing research on how social ties influence people's decision-making for how to evacuate with Hurricane Maria, you know, and who had access to being able to evacuate or not. You know, if you don't speak English as a first language or don't have a car to leave, don't have money for a hotel, you know, you might stay during a storm. And then during a storm, we did some research with a report called Views That Matter, Race and Opinions on Climate Change in Greater Boston, and found that, unfortunately, white respondents were much more likely to have, you know, multiple days of prescriptions or an evacuation plan or backup power or flood insurance, you know, different things that are, you know, extra food. So there are all these things that, like, in the first few days or, like, in the immediacy of a storm that people don't have access to. And then after a storm, there's even more issues, right? Like, we know that for figuring out how to rebuild, applying for federal aid, there's lots and lots of things to navigate that are really challenging. And research showed after Harvey in Texas that the racial wealth gap widened in communities that were hit. The wealth gap between homeowners and renters widened. The wealth gap between people with more education and less education widened. But what was particularly upsetting to me about that study was that places that had FEMA aid had wider gaps than places that didn't. And that's just awful. Like, the point of having aid is not to make the rich richer, but to ensure that everybody can be safe and healthy. So as we're thinking about these impacts, we need to be really intentional about what are the policies, what are the programs, how are we making sure that everybody can be safe.
All right. Thank you for that. And in our last, just in a sentence or two, Andrew, the call to action for communities right now.
I think it's coming to grips with reality and, you know, engaging our community and our public in some difficult conversations about where we can hold our ground and where we have to retreat and adjust and adapt so that future generations will be able to enjoy a changed Cape Cod in a way that bears any resemblance to the current Cape Cod we all grew up and fell in love with.
All right. Andrew Gottlieb is the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. And Rebecca Hurst is the director of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at UMass Boston. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
And Rebecca, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.